Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
Thank you all for listening to Football is Family. Today we have a special guest, Oz Davis, from the Truly the GOAT podcast, part of the Sports History Network family of podcasters. We have a great group of talented men who are giving you the basics of the sports history that you love. And Oz Davis is one of them. We've had several on this podcast in the past. Today, Oz is going to talk about his love of the Los Angeles Rams, not so much St. Louis, but, you know, Cleveland as well, but the Los Angeles Rams. And we're going to talk a lot about the 70s and a lot about what's going on today. So I hope you enjoy that. Before we get into the podcast itself, I want to give you a couple of recommendations of books and magazines. Now, magazines, if you don't know what they are, they're these floppy things made of paper. They're not on digital. They're not on the computer. I am an old school type of guy when it comes to my material. I want to hold it in my hands. I like comic books in paperback, in form like that. And I like magazines and books in paper. This in particular is Lindy Sports. It came out a couple of weeks ago with the pro football preview for the 2021 edition. That is that now. It's something I tend to buy every year, especially when we get into fantasy football season, which is coming up pretty soon. So that is out. But I want to give you a couple of recommendations. I got Rich Smelter's book, Chicago Assassin. This is not a book about sports, but it's a book about Machine Gun Jack McGurn and his reign during the beer wars in Chicago in the Roaring Twenties. I encourage you to pick that up if you can. And John Eisenberg's book, Cotton Bowl Days, I should say, growing up with Dallas and the Cowboys in the 1960s. Both books I would recommend. Both great men who've written these books. So I encourage you to look at those books. They're available online. And if you're interested, go and look it up and check out these authors. Again, I hope you enjoy today's episode of the Football is Family podcast. Next week, as of right now, I am planning on doing something that is a little bit interesting in the sense that you never think of WWE, WWF, or WCW in football, but there's a lot of similarities, especially with the people who played football who later became wrestlers. Can you smell what The Rock is cooking? That's what we're going to talk about next week. Thank you. We'll see you then. And we're back to Football is Family podcast, and I've got a special guest. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Oz Davis of the Truly the Goats podcast here at the Sports History Network. I'm pleased to be here.
Well, Oz, I'm glad that you're here. We had a kind of a conflict of interest yesterday. He was supposed to be on yesterday, which this is a Tuesday, Monday. I actually got rid of all three of my kids for a few days, and my wife and I ran long actually getting to know each other, because you don't get to see each other with kids. It just doesn't happen.
Okay. You know what? That's great. I love this excuse. I used to be, when I was living in Budapest in Hungary, I was an English teacher, and very often I was teaching. I was going to these people's offices and teaching, you know, three or four students at a time. And invariably, people would show up late and they'd go, traffic. Sorry, I'm late, traffic. Right? And I know it's Monday, it's Tuesday morning, it's 8 o'clock. I know it's not traffic. I know you're... And I used to chastise everybody for this. It's like, give me a different excuse. So finally, one of my students walks in and goes, sorry, I'm late, I was having sex with my wife. And I was like, all right. There you go.
This is how football becomes family, by adding to it like that. There you go. Now, the thing that you are going to talk about today, are the Rams. Now, we talked before that the Rams have a long history. We're going to talk about the history, but before we get into that, I've got some numbers that I want to run by you, okay? And after that, I think you have something you're going to add, and then we're going to talk about why you like the Rams. So they were founded in 1936 in Cleveland, of all places. And if I remember correctly, they are the only team that, after winning a championship, moved.
In any sport, really.
In any sport.
Unless you want to talk about like the Philadelphia Stars and the USFL, because I think they did that. I think they won a championship and then moved to Baltimore. But that was fiscal necessity.
Fiscal necessity.
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things about them moving, is that it's not a case of Stan Kroenke or Carol Rosenblum, who was a later owner of the Rams, where they live in Los Angeles. And so they want to bring the team here. The owner of the Cleveland Rams, and I have the name here somewhere.
I believe it's Dan Reeves.
That's right, Dan Reeves. I'm terrible at names, which is a real drawback for somebody doing this kind of thing. He specifically wanted to move to Los Angeles to play in the Coliseum. That's what he wanted to do. And when he requested a move to Los Angeles, the leagues at first said no. And then he threatened to sue them. He threatened to dissolve the team, not move them to the AAFC, which was a competitor league, which he could have also threatened to do. Despite, you know, the Browns being there, who were also awesome.
I went and wanted to play the Browns at that time.
Right. And so, you know, he threatened to do all these things because for him, he was kind of a businessman first, a franchise owner second. He was almost a reverse Al Davis. You know, he's a bizarro Al Davis, right? Didn't care about football. Didn't care. Wanted that Roman thing, right? Wanted to put his product before 90,000, 100,000 people every week directly, which he almost did.
Yeah.
By the way, by the mid-50s. In 1957, they set a record for, GATE, basically. That stood for 48 years, stood until 2005. Because the Coliseum, in theory, could put in 105,000. They often did that for USC games in those days. Can you imagine in the 50s putting 105,000 people in there?
Good gracious.
Even for Los Angeles, that's a sizable part of your population in one small area. So they set a record that stayed until 2005, and they went 6-6 that year. it's like, wow. I mean, it just goes to show, I mean, what an awesome move that was.
Well, Kroenke would love that right now.
I'm
hearing that the parking in Los Angeles is insanely expensive.
Oh, my God.
But they played in Cleveland, went to Los Angeles. Now, when I grew up, I remember the Los Angeles Rams and Jim, or Chris Everett, as Jim Rome would say, I remember them, and I remember when they moved to St. Louis, and then they came back, obviously, to L.A.
Okay.
Now, according to the internet's never wrong, okay? They played in I've seen that. It's never wrong, okay?
But remember what Abraham Lincoln said. Not everything you read on the internet is true.
I read that
on the internet.
Yeah, I also heard that he said drop beats, not bombs.
Exactly.
I'm just saying. They played in 4 Super Bowls. They're 1-3. And the one Super Bowl they played in, I actually have a hat over there. Lids.com had a $5 hat thing, and it was the Titans St. Louis Rams Super Bowl. And I don't want to talk about that one. We're going to move on. According to Pro Football Reference, all right, ready? They played 85 seasons. Mm-hmm. They've had a pretty good record for 85 seasons, 587 wins, 575 losses, and 21 ties. Now, that's pretty good. Mm-hmm. I mean,
this is a team who's okay. First, you can say that, like teams like the Cleveland Browns and the Detroit Lions, this is a team whose golden age was really in the 50s, right? I mean, we can talk about the 70s in a moment, which was also really awesome for them as well. But the 50s was the big deal. I mean, I think it's between 49 and 55. They're playing for the championship four times. So it's four times in 7 years. So this is akin to like the Pittsburgh Steelers later on. Let's say did it four times in 6 years.
Yeah.
So it's on that level. Or Patriots, you know, it's kind of on that level. And they win one. And I was in 57, I believe. This shows how well I versed on the 50s football. Now, I remember the Rams from the 70s. The 70s was another peak era for them. They won the NFC West back when it was five teams. They won it, and there's three divisions in each conference. They won it 7 years in a row. The last one of those culminated in Super Bowl 14.
Right.
And that was when, you know, they lost to, they were leading those Pittsburgh Steelers that I just mentioned, in fact, in the fourth quarter, but could not pull it out.
Yeah.
It was also... It
Darren was Hayes is loving that, by the way. He is absolutely loving that.
Yeah. He popped into my head for some reason just then. The thing about the Rams at that time, and even as a kid we knew this, was the fearsome foursome.
Right.
Now, this was the second go around of the fearsome foursome. I'm not old enough to recall the first one. Which is Rosie Greer, Deacon Jones, Merlin Olsen, guys like that. However, I did know them through TV, right? This was, see, the significance of the Rams moving to Los Angeles in 47 is very multifold, right? It's very multidimensional, okay? One of the things it says is, okay, this is the growth of America. Right, like Los Angeles, this is their first pro team. Los Angeles is finally becoming, guess what, a major league city. You know, like cities like Las Vegas and Charlotte are experiencing recently, right? They're becoming a major league city, right? That's a big deal, okay? But also, soon after that, Hollywood, Burbank, right? These guys realize that, and again, they're making pretty much working man's wages still as a professional football player. They realize that, hey, I can do Little House on the Prairie.
Yes.
I can do Bud Light commercials, right? I can be playing a Native American son of John Wayne in a movie like Roman Gabriel did, right? I mean, that was a draw. And this helped the Rams through the 70s, 80s, 90s. Players like, who was it? Rosie Greer came here so that maybe I could go on TV. It's Los Angeles. I want to be a star, right? Because again, football players aren't making millions a year like now. They're not making the equivalent either before anybody thinks that. They're not making like awesome wages like they are now. Have, you know, do a couple episodes of Hollywood Squares. And bam, you might double your salary that you made playing football. So this was a draw for their teams. And in the 70s, they were able to assemble guys who wanted to play in Los Angeles, like Jack Youngblood. Let's see, I have the list here somewhere. I'm drawing up a list of their awesome second fearsome foursome. This is okay. This is great radio here.
Oh, it's
we had Jack Youngblood, Fred Dreyer, and Larry Brooks, and
Merlin Fred Dreyer. You know, my mind just blinked out on the show he was in, but it was awesome. Hunter. TV show. Hunter. Absolutely.
And guess why he did that? Because it was in Los Angeles. Fred Dreyer is also the answer to a very important trivia question. Again, this will show you how dominant the Rams defensive line is. He is the only guy to get two sacks in a game, and he did it in one quarter. Again, yeah, just an indication of how awesome the Rams defense was in those days. They couldn't hold the Steelers to under 31 in the Super Bowl, however. And, you know, of course it helped. One of the things that also helped is we had a couple of great coaches in those days. You know, George Allen.
Yes.
Was mainly the coach in the 70s. Ray Malavasi, most people don't remember, he's actually the one that took over for Allen and you know, got them to the Super Bowl, got them to a couple more conference championships after that. So they had some great coaching in the 60s and 70s as well. And again, that draw just coming to Los Angeles also now, helped.
They brought over John Robinson. And he is, according to Pro Football Reference, their winningest coach. And now, if I remember correctly, he was a USC coach. Now, was he USC coach before or after this?
I believe it was before. I was thinking it was before. Yeah, because John McKay, who became the Buccaneers coach, their first head coach, he came over from USC, right?
Yes, he did.
He was the one who was the head coach when O.J. Simpson and guys like that were there. And that's when USC was still a good football team. Jeez. Living in Southern California, I hear a lot about how bad they are nowadays. And they are pretty bad. So that was the thing about the Rams in those days, too, is that I don't know if this was purposely or not, but a lot, they would draw on the UCLAs and the USCs quite a bit. I mean, Pat Hayden,
yes,
was the quarterback in those on those 70s teams. And a lot of people felt that he overstayed his welcome. If he had been playing nowadays, there's no way he would have been in contention on and off starting quarterback for 8 years with the same team. No way. That just wouldn't happen nowadays. But again, it just kind of goes to show USC boy makes good, right? He was at best kind of and maybe above average quarterback, you know, maybe an Andy Dalton level. But because the defense was so good, when Allen was there, I think he was there for like 7 or 8 seasons. Every year they won 10 or more games, and the year they didn't, they won 9 games. Yeah, so pretty good coaching there. And I was in 14-game seasons as well, I should point out. And they had a lot of 12-2s, a lot of 10-4s in those days.
Now,
so, glory days.
One of the names that I love and is Vince Ferragamo. Mm-hmm. Quarterback. Right. I believe he was a quarterback in the Super Bowl in 79.
Yep.
Probably if you want to have a superhero name, that's Ferragamo. Now, I am looking at probably one of the best defensive ends, if not the best, then he is top five, definitely, Deacon Jones. Now, before Deacon Jones came around, they didn't keep up with sacks. And if I remember correctly, this man coined the name sack.
Wow, that could be. Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. I don't think that the league officially has it down to him. But sure, why not? Because that's what he did.
I'm not going to argue with the guy named Deacon Jones, you know?
Right. That and, you know, his thing was the head slap.
Yeah, it wouldn't work today.
Yeah, right. That was a legal maneuver. And, you know, I did an episode of Truly the Goats on Angelo Mosca, who is, you know, basically the Deacon Jones of the CFL, but pretty much at the same time as well. And that was his thing, too. And that was a legal move, you know, and he got it from Deacon Jones. He's like, I want to crush guys like that. And so literally the coaches are teaching him how to do it. That was a perfectly legal move. But the thing was, is to put the fear of God in the opposition, no pun intended, from a guy named Deacon. But, you know, that'll do it. I'm not sure he needed to do it. I mean, if you take a guy and you make him as proportionally big today as he was in those days, he'd be a badass without having to resort to that. Because, again, I'm not old enough to have seen him play, but I've seen a lot of highlight films with him. A lot of those 70s Rams games.
Now, he wasn't the fastest, but he had a get-off-the-line quickness that was almost like a cat.
Well, that was the thing about the fearsome foursome, right? I mean, it's just like you had four guys coming at you that were so quick off the line. I mean, any one of them could break through, And if they didn't break through, you'd get stuffed at the line. Now, one of the statistics, of course, they did keep in those days was opposition rushing yards. And if you look at it in those years, the Rams are number one every year. I mean, they're stuffing that run. And in those days, of course, those are the days of 60, 66% run. If you're losing, you're still running the ball two times out of three, right? Which we would never do nowadays. So, and the Rams were the best at stopping that. So, that was the thing about those guys. I mean, they were just, you just look at the tape. It's amazing. And the thing is, like, when George Allen came in, he shed those guys, except for Merlin. To be honest, most of them were past their prime, but kept the philosophy. This is why guys like Youngblood were so effective. I mean, that's what he was doing. He was just crushing through the line, like as soon as the ball was snapped. It was almost like he was psychic coming off that line. It was something to see.
Now, Jack Youngblood is one of those guys that when you look at him, you don't really see how just of a man he was. Now, if I remember correctly, he had his leg broken and still played in the Super Bowl.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. I remember that. It's one of those things. It's not quite the Theismann thing because it wasn't, so nicely framed
in the camera. Yeah.
But you could feel that. And, I'm a kid watching that. So, I was like maybe 14 when I was watching that. So it's nice and firm in my brain forever. I don't know to say that they wouldn't do that nowadays, because there's a lot of times when guys reveal how messed up they are, after the game is over. Maybe they don't want to give anything away, but you get the, again, this is the 70s and early 80s. And I always come back to this. And if you look at the 70s in any sport, pick your sport, it's just so amazingly violent and hard and permissive as well. I'm sure that this dude for the Super Bowl was really jacked up. Okay, they gave him some great painkillers. He thought he was Superman. I'm sure of it. I'm not sure how he felt after that Super Bowl.
I remember
he played a damn good game too.
He did. He did. I remember when Tim Crumbry against the San Francisco 49ers had his leg just go crazy. It was just nasty looking. And that is my equivalent to that. Of course, I'm looking across my office here. I have you can't see it, Oz, but there's a cutout of Mark Mariani. He used to play wide receiver for my Titans. Great. I like the guy. Great guy from Montana. He broke his leg in a very similar way to Jack Youngblood, and they kept showing the replay. And my wife said, "Come here, look at this." And I'm like, I'm over here turning green. She said, "Look at." I'm like, "No, just doesn't work like that."
Now that's something they don't do anymore either. Is they don't replay the vicious incident over and over and over again.
And when they say that, turn your head if you're squeamish. Of course, no one's going to turn their head. No one. And then they're going to say, why did I look? It's like a freight train wreck. You're going to look. Now,
oh, yeah. I mean, I was just having this conversation the other day about, you know, talking about Formula One versus NASCAR. And they're going, how can you stand that Formula One? I'm like, dude, the tracks are different. And, you know, the scenery is awesome. And the drivers are fantastic. And dude's like, yeah, but they never crash. I just, come on. Are you serious? Now, he was a hockey player. Still, I mean, that's the reason why people watch these car crashes. And people do get off on the vicious stuff. But, you know, I was watching, like, for example, I was watching the Euro Cup the other day. Or this was actually a couple of weeks ago now, when the guy on Denmark just, you know, had a heart attack and pitched there on the field. They didn't even show that again. You know, the guy just basically, like, collapsed. There's nothing to it. It wasn't like he got hit or anything. I mean, soccer. It wasn't like he got hit or anything. It's not like he even hit his head. You know, he just kind of like fell down.
Well,
but no, we're not going to show it again. So well, it's like.
You were talking about how bad it was in the 70s. I didn't know this, but Rudy Tomjanovich playing for the Rockets, I believe, got his face rearranged with a sucker punch.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked at that on YouTube. And I'm like, oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's that famous one of Larry Bird getting clotheslined against Detroit. And, you know, then there's that one where, like, what is it? Barkley and Malone are holding him down and Julius is punching him. Julius, because he just had talked so much trash at him the whole game.
But he knew, you know, exactly, like, what he was doing.
That's, well, of course. But, and, you know, that's the early 80s, but still coming out of the 70s. But again, like, seriously, fans, like, no matter what your sport is, just look at the 70s, man. It's hardcore. I mean, cricket is violent in the 70s, you know, and that's, you know, seriously. I mean, okay, tennis, maybe not so much. That's not a contest.
Well, but, talk to Monica Seles back in the day.
Well, there you go. But now, everything else, man.
Before we go any further, I want you to see if you could pull up the our sponsor for today.
Oh, I've got that. Yeah, sure. Let's talk about what I half jokingly often refer to as quite possibly the greatest website of all time. I'm talking about newspapers.com. Now, if you're listening to this podcast or any of the Sports History Network podcast, you're probably into sports history. And you probably also know that in order to do real research, in order just to find out about those old times, to do a typical search engine is useless. It's really hard to find anything prior to, let's say, 1990 that doesn't bring you to Wikipedia, a 2-minute YouTube, or, I mean, what else can you get? What else would you get in this situation, Jeremy? If I look up something like 1974 New York Giants, what am I going to get?
You will get clickbait, and you would get...
clickbait.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, so in other words, nothing you haven't heard before. But if you want to get a real flavor for that time, you want to get a real flavor for the era of your choice, anytime from literally the late 18th century to the present day, newspapers.com. 640 million pages worth of newsprint that you can draw from I believe it's 10 different countries, six of which are English speaking. You've got the US, you've got Canada, you've got England, you've got Ireland, you've got Scotland, you've got Australia in there. Lots of great stuff. Hey, if you're into cricket, like I just name dropped, lots of great stuff to find there. What do you want to find? You can find the real time stuff right there. Just the other day, I did a little investigation. Don't mean to be a wet blanket here. Jeremy, I take it you've seen the movie Hoosiers. Everybody's seen this.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, this is inspired by true events. I actually did some research on the actual school that this is based on newspapers.com recently. That was a lot of fun. It's actually a school called Wingate. And the 7-man team from a very small school actually happened in, I believe it was, I want to say 1913, maybe. So different flavor of sports reportage. And this is basketball back in its early days. I believe they won the championship that year, 38-6 was the final score in basketball. Right. This is the Indiana State High School title, ladies and gentlemen. But the point here is only at newspapers.com are you really going to read this stuff. Are you really going to feel that time? And as I always like to point out, get a free one-week subscription to newspapers.com and help support Sports History Network podcast financially. I can't emphasize enough by visiting sportshistorynetwork.com/newspapers. Thanks very much for giving it a try. You will not be disappointed. That's sportshistorynetwork.com/newspapers.
Speaking of not being disappointed, 33 men have been inducted into the Hall of Fame, Pro Football Hall of Fame, who have either played on or retired with the Los Angeles, Cleveland, St. Louis, Los Angeles Rams.
Yeah.
Probably the best one is Bob Waterfield, not because of just how he played, but because of who he married. I'll just be honest. I mean, I'll just be honest. Jane Mansfield, back in the day.
Yeah. Wasn't she the number one pinup girl in World War II?
That I wouldn't doubt it.
Like, she had the number one picture, I believe.
I wouldn't doubt it. See?
Yeah.
It reminds me of Bob Hope calling Marilyn Monroe out in front of the soldiers, I believe, in Korea, or maybe even in Vietnam, said, look at what you're fighting for here. And I said, yep.
That's right. That's right. And speaking of legs and the loss and the Rams, we have a long history of Hall of Famers, along with Waterfield, like I mentioned before, the early Golden Age teams, really. Was Crazy Legs Hirsch.
Yes.
What, not only one of the early great receivers, but also one of the all-time great nicknames in
football. Well, I did some research on that, and they said he was crazy because of how he ran. He ran with abandon. He did not run in a straight line, so the name Crazy Legs. Now, here's the problem I have with the Rams. They seem to get rid of running backs at least two times a little bit too early.
Well, gee, we picked up Marshall Faulk at exactly the right time, though, huh?
You did.
That was the one score. And the thing about Todd Gurley is...
Well, not even Gurley.
Sorry?
Eric Dickerson, Jerome Bettis.
Well, yeah, the Bettis thing was weird, but those, of course, were the lean years when I find a lot of times in the NFL when a team has a string of lean years, like the Rams had 12 years in the 21st century, and it was like a 9-year run back in the 90s where just nothing, just no playoffs, not even a hope of getting to 500. I find that when that happens, that a lot of bad stuff is happening in the front office as well.
Oh yeah.
Like if you look at the Lions, who bottomed out famously at 0-16 back in the 2000s, Matt Millen, of course, was their GM. And this is historically one of the worst GMs ever. I mean, drafting wide receivers in the first round, 3 straight years with a top 10 pick, for example, stuff like that will gut your franchise. You know, and I think that's kind of the thing that was happening with the Rams at that time. It's just that, you know, there's a level of apathy here. You know, Georgia Frontier, who's now owner of the team, just doesn't want to pay anybody because not so secretly, she wants to move the team back to her hometown. You know, and it's just like nobody, you know. It's like a situation where one hand doesn't know what the other hand's doing, except this is like a handless team. So there's just like nobody's really paying attention. There's a string of coaches, Spagnuolo, probably the best example, that just never coach again. That's always a bad sign. Again, this was representative of those Detroit Lions teams that were so bad. Same kind of thing happened there. Other teams like this, this tends to happen. So I chalk up that one to that. Dickerson, and this actually came back to haunt him later on, always kind of had a checkered, relationship with the front office. Not really sure why. He's one of the best players the Los Angeles Rams ever had until nowadays, when we only have, in my opinion, the best player in the league, but definitely the best defensive player in the league. I think a lot of it was politics, basically. And it's interesting too, because in the Rams' other low point, which was when your boy Jeff Fisher came and ran the franchise into the ground so that we could move the team. He was no judge of talent whatsoever. Dickerson in those days used to hang out on the sideline. There is just kind of like a local press guy, just kind of like a goodwill guy, like a Magic Johnson would do for the Lakers, or Tommy Lasorda always used to do for the Dodgers. Right. And so he was there on the sideline, just kind of hanging out, whatever. And then, he teed off in the media a couple of times, like everybody else did, on Fisher at the end, including Todd Gurley, who I'll talk about in a moment, And so Fisher actually had him banned from the sidelines, right? And it's like, I don't know what Fisher was thinking, that he was going to win in a popularity contest in Los Angeles, where a lot of people my age still remember the Los Angeles Rams, and Dickerson. I just don't understand what. But in any case, so that's what I blame the Dickerson thing on. And the Gurley is the real shame. Todd Gurley is the real shame. Because again, here's Fisher running this team into the ground while this guy's having his best years. It's kind of like Deshaun Watson in Houston.
Oh yeah.
It's like why you're running this team into the ground and this guy, his best years are now, because this guy, he's a halfback. He's not going to last forever. Gurley is a guy who, going into college, he wanted to play basketball. Like, that was his first love. And basically his coach begged him to play football because he was so good. And geez, he was good. But Fisher was just wasting him. I don't know if you were following the Rams in those days when Fisher was running them into the ground and, St. Louis was a graveyard. But opposition would routinely put 9-10 in the box because they knew we weren't going to throw it. We knew we were just going to go to Gurley. Our line was young, so he's probably going to have to run it up the middle, which he doesn't like to do. And so that's when Gurley finally came out and said, I'm tired of running this grade school offense. So there you go. That's our checkered history with running backs in a nutshell, from my perspective.
Well, Jeff Fisher left Tennessee in a bad situation, but I'm sitting here with a autographed Jeff Fisher football right here behind me. I've got to meet him before. I'm still waiting for that picture from the Titans, because I got to meet him and they took a picture and never gave it to me. And that's been a few years ago. Jeff Fisher had people love him here.
Oh, sure.
So we followed him when he was in St. Louis, and we were surprised, I guess, that he got fired. But looking back, it was about a year too late. Now, Jeff Fisher, if you want an 8-8 team, that's the guy.
Yeah, that was the thing.
He kept the Oilers together during the move. Jeff Fisher. Yeah. And I'm looking across. I have a picture of somebody drew something called a championship dream, where a child with his dogs laying on a bed, and a picture above him is Jeff Fisher going with his hand on his chin. Jeff Fisher is the kind of guy that could keep a team together. And when I heard that there was a possibility St. Louis could move, I thought they got the right guy to do that, because he's been through it.
Well, yeah, I was talking about a trivia question before about Fred Hunter Dreyer. Fisher's another one. I mean, he's got to be the only head coach to have moved two franchises in the modern era. He's got to be.
I would say.
Who else is there?
I'm thinking about other teams that have moved as many times as the Rams. It would be the Raiders.
No one. Because the Rams have actually moved four times. You forget, they moved to Anaheim.
Yes, you're right. They played at Anaheim. That's right.
Right. Now, they call themselves Los Angeles, kind of like how the Angels sometimes do this, right? But let me tell you, I live in Orange County now. I've lived out here for about 5 or 6 years, okay? Anaheim is not Los Angeles, okay? They're not. I mean, I don't understand why a team like the Angels just didn't bite the bullet a long time ago and call themselves the South California Angels.
I remember them with when they were the California Angels. I love that.
Yeah.
I thought that was great.
Yeah, but see, that's pretentious. That's ignoring the A's, the Giants, the Padres. You know?
I like tradition. And to me, when they went to Anaheim Angels, I'm like, you know what?
But remember, they started as the Los Angeles Angels. Why do you think they're called the Angels?
Right? The City of Angels. It makes a lot of sense.
And that was another thing I wanted to point out about the Rams, too. When they made this move in 47, I mean, to me, this is in a lot of ways one of the more significant moves in NFL history, along with the merger and the AFC buyout.
Right.
Is because not only do you get this expansion out west, and the NFL likes to say they were the first coast-to-coast league and whatnot, right? But also, as part of the lease agreement for the Coliseum, they had to agree to integrate, right? And so the Rams are the first NFL team to sign a black player. Now, why? I'm not sure why it is that. Hang on, just a moment. Blank. I'm not sure why it is that Kenny Washington is not a household name, but there you go. Well, there's the first African American player signed.
When you think about it, baseball being America's sport, Jackie Robinson's going to be known. Football, football really came about after 58.
Right.
Now, if I remember this correctly, too, and I think I found this information in the NFL Century book by Joe Horrigan, which is an exceptional book. The Rams would be the first NFL team to paint a logo on their helmet.
Yes.
Now, I think Michigan would be the first team to do that. Okay. I want to say Michigan is the first college team, but the pros, and they had, and I forgot who did it. The name was in my head just a little bit ago. He stenciled it in a helmet and had a couple different designs. And the helmet that you see now is very similar to the original helmet.
Yeah, I don't like the splash of green very much, but it's the best logo in football. It is. It's the best logo in football because when the line gets into that set position, they look like Rams. It is awesome. I would also put the Vikings very high up there. But as we understand now, the Vikings never wore helmets like that.
Valid. But I would hold. I would take your statement about the Vikings and tweak it. Go back to the Fran Tarkington era. That purple.
Oh, well, the color. I mean, look, purple is my favorite color.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, go back to the old school purple. Mm-hmm. And while we're at it, go back to the old school Kelly green for the Eagles. None of this new stuff. Go back to the Kelly green.
Yeah. And Cunningham. In hoops, I think the Celtics should go back to just green and white. I don't like the gold so much. Same thing with the Rams getting back to it. The splash of green adds nothing. The point of that logo, and I mean, look, outside of context, the logo looks like crap. It's not one of the best logos by a long shot, right? Just on its own.
Right.
But in the context of the helmet, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I don't understand why more teams don't do that. But then again, don't take my word for it, because one of my other favorite helmets is the Cincinnati Bengals, and almost everybody hates that.
I was watching something today. I think it was from TPS.com. Was talking about the worst logos in the NFL, and the Bengals were number three worst, and of course the Titans were number six worst. And at that point, I exited out because because here's the thing.
I like the Titans logo.
I appreciate that. Nashville is the Athens of the South. You have the T for the Titans, and you have the three stars for the three geographic areas of Tennessee, East, Middle, and West. And then the flame means that we're on fire with Derek.
And I love blue and blue. I love light blue, dark blue. That's a great color combination. I don't know why more sports teams don't use it.
I told my wife I'm getting my car painted two-tone blue. She looked at me like I was going crazy, and I said, I'm not stuttering. It's what's going to happen. So I might be sleeping on the couch tonight, Oz, but you know, hey, it is. I'm going to take it for the team. John Robinson, if you're listening, I need a place to stay.
Nice. There are very few. I think most logos in the NFL, I mean, maybe I'm easy, but I think most of them are really great. I really like the Steelers. You know, I like how they tweet the scientific, representation of steel. That's awesome. I like that. I think that there are some bad ones. Of course, the all-time worst was the old Washington logo, which we don't really need to talk about. But for example, the Patriots logo, I'm sorry. I know they went on the Super Bowls with that, but it still sucks.
Go back to Patriot Pat.
Oh, yeah.
He looks like he's about to play football right before he goes to Lexington Concord.
Sure, yeah, it's great. And plus, you know, Boston really, I mean, it's a cliche, but especially if you go to downtown, Boston is all about the history. They really take a lot of pride in the history and everything. So it should be, I mean, like some Boston journalists called it at the time, Elvis on acid. You know, that's what that is. It's Elvis, like, flying through an acid trip. Yeah, that's what the logo is.
Go back. And Seattle, please go back to the Steve Largent Seattle Seahawks. Please go back to that.
Really? Is it that different for you?
It is that different. I ever play on Madden, if I ever play the Seahawks, I go back and play with those, the Kingdom days.
On Madden?
Oh, I cannot handle – I get the new one. I get it. I do –
Well, let me ask you this. Do you ever play the Titans with Oilers unis?
Yes, I do. In fact, when I play the season, franchise, they let you pick, and I will pick the powder blue.
Oh, that's another thing. Since we're on the subject of uniforms, that's another thing I should say about the Rams. Okay. I think, since we're talking about what teams should do as far as uniforms go, I think we should be wearing those blue and yellows all the time. One of the things that really cheesed me off about St. Louis Rams is blue and gold. No way. Look, I got two daughters, okay, two teenage daughters. They could give about sports of any sort, right? But, you know, I'm sitting here watching the Rams. I do every Sunday. I watch the Rams when football season's on. Got the big screen and everything. Okay. And so one of my daughters is passing through the room one day. They're playing in the blue and yellows. She stops and looks at it and goes, wow, those are great uniforms. It's like, you know, somebody who knows, I mean, those are dope uniforms. And, of course, those come from the 70s, which high point of the franchise.
Oh, absolutely. Let's get back to NFL. If you're looking for fashion advice, come to us. I've got a 13-year-old. I got an 8-year-old daughter as well. They know fashion. They basically say, Daddy, you cannot leave the house until we approve you.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's not good.
You've got a tyranny going on there.
I told my son, like, if there's four or five guys in a room and there's one girl, you're still outnumbered. Just deal with it. You have no chance. But Oz, I appreciate your time. The Los Angeles Rams, SoFi Stadium looks amazing. They are the team in there. The Chargers, you guys should have stayed in San Diego. That's Los Angeles is not your city.
You don't know the half of it, dude. You would be shocked. I mean, okay. This is the other thing. This is the other important point about the Rams at all. Okay, they were the first team in Los Angeles on that highest level of pro sports in, let's say, the Big Four.
Right.
Okay, but now, today, we have six teams in four professional sports. One of them is natural to Los Angeles. Okay? That is the Los Angeles Kings. Those are our only true team. Okay? Unless you want to count the Chargers, who started, played one season in Los Angeles, moved away, came back.
I don't count that.
Yeah, that's like, that's like remarrying the wife you divorced. Right? So I don't think that counts. Okay. So, but that's the argument, right? Is that LA itself is a town of transplants. And the thing is, like people were saying, when for 25 years or 22 years, I think it was, Los Angeles did not have an NFL team. They're saying, oh, it's a crummy football town. Oh, it's a crummy NFL town. It isn't. It's just that people come here and they bring their teams, right? That's the way it is. The main fan base of the Los Angeles Rams now is guys my age, Generation X, right? That because we remember the Rams, right? We remember the Los Angeles Rams. Everybody else already has another team. Sorry. And the Chargers, I would guess they're maybe the 12th, maybe 13th most popular team. Honestly, I can easily find you more Patriots fans in Los Angeles than Chargers fans. Easily. And of course, the Raiders, who cares if they're in Las Vegas? They got a lot of fans in Los Angeles still. A lot. this is the 21st century, baby. Home team? Doesn't matter. Chargers, you might as well just move to Portland, Maine, for all it's worth. Doesn't matter. Nobody cares about you, man.
You heard it here. Thank you. Thank you, Oz, for your time tonight.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure, Jeremy.
Has been Football is Family.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
The Pigskin Tales podcast is all about the lesser-known pro football players. Yes, there are stories about the ones we know, like Brad Tarkenton and Harold Red Grange. But have you ever heard of Ernie Nevers? How about Dave Osborne or even Grady Alderman? These men created their own path to the NFL. How did they do it? Listen to the Pigskin Tales podcast. Now streaming on your favorite music platform. Go to pigskintales.com.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.